present.
Well, this is what we're here for this morning, is to hear Jim give his message to us, his experience, strength, and hope. So I'm not going to delay it any longer. I want to welcome Jim C. from Grand Blanc.
My name is Jim, and I am an alcoholic. Good morning. I wasn't really sure what I was going to talk about when I came. I never followed through to define it, and I was just told to talk on spirituality. But I find out that it's really just to share my story. Either one of them makes me scared. But I thought of something when Judy spoke and said the number of people that were here. And it's one of the things that makes all AA meeting beneficial for me. When I walked in that door, I walked in with the power of one. Me, mine. And I find out, give or take, I am in the presence of power to the 800th degree. Do you know what you call this power? Greater power. So that helps relieve my anxieties and tensions. I'm willing to break my own personal anonymity. I don't necessarily give anyone else the right to do that, but I'm willing to break it and to tell you that my name is not only Jim C., but it is Jim Koch. C-O-K-E. Isn't that a significant name? Because some of you are going to have to go, this is the last thing you're going to listen to at the end of this conference, and you're going to have to go home perhaps and tell a spouse who's been doing something, a grandmother, a mother, taking care of your children. You're going to have to go home and tell them, do you know how they ended this retreat, or this conference? They ended it with Coke. And indeed, 230 pounds of uncut coke. Explain that one. Your spouse at home or mother may say, you're not going to any more of those meetings. How long did it take me to get to Midland, Michigan? How long did it take me to get here? To Valley Plaza Inn. You know how long it took me, dear friends? My whole life. It took me my whole life to get to this precious moment. I never expected or planned to be here. So, what's the journey? What's the journey that got me here? Began a great number of years ago for me. in the fourth grade. I'm a total Catholic school product. I went to Catholic grammar school, I went to Catholic high school, I went to Catholic college. In the school that I attended, when you got to the fourth grade, if your marks were right and you had brown-nosed enough, Sister Mary Leona would choose you to be a server at religious services at Mass. I wasn't a bad student, but I was a good brown noser. So I was selected to be a server. And in those days, the Roman ceremonial was all in Latin. No one understood a thing, including the priest. I found that out much later, that they didn't understand a thing, what they were saying. But I was a very impressionable child and highly romantic. And when I was made, selected to be a server, I'm telling you, I was enchanted, enamored with the ceremonial, the movement, the solemnity, the mystery of this foreign language. And I was serving, I watched the priest at the altar, I watched him closely, observed everything he did, every little movement that he made with his hands, his eyes, his head, his body, anything. And I went home, and we had a lovely recreation room in our basement, and over in one corner we had a beautiful old-time Victrola. Anyone knows what a Victrola is? And it was electric, too. And I got out a white sheet and covered it all over to make it look like a table and an altar, and I got two candlesticks, and there was a bar over in the corner, and there was cupboards in there, and I went over and got a cocktail glass. I went out and I bought a package of what we call Boston wafers. My home is Cleveland, Ohio. You call them Necco wafers. I use those for the bread, the altar bread. And I got water. Pop. Soda. And I went to this altar and I started playing Mass. Pretending I was a priest. Did all the movements, had my prayer book open there, and went through everything, you know. For you who are Catholic, old Catholic, that doesn't sound familiar. And I would go through this whole thing. One day, I got an idea. Because in our basement there was a lovely room called the wine cellar. And in that wine cellar were all kinds of shelves. And my mother had all kinds of different kinds of wines lying on the shelf, like this. Lying on their side. She maintained that that made for a better wine. Aging time and lying it on the side, letting it rest, she called that. Let the bottle rest. And let a little bit of it touch the cork. And that increases the quality of the wine. I don't know if it does or not. But believe you me, when I got this idea, let me tell you, those wine bottles stopped resting. I just got this idea. There's wine there. I could have a real authentic mass. It would be more authentic than using the water in the pot. So I did. I went in and I got a wine bottle. But can you imagine? I was already cunning. Because I knew right away my mother will see that. So I learned in the fourth grade how to water bottles. But I will never forget that moment. It's vivid in my mind and my memory. I got that wine, used it, had a little jar I had in there. Came and I poured it into the little cocktail glass. And I began the mass. I went through everything like that. All the rituals, all the gestures and everything. And I got to the point of communion. So I took the little Necco wafer, as the priest did, as I always watched them. They used to take the bread and make a sign, big sign of the cross with it. And then feed themselves. And then fold their hands in meditative prayer. And pick up the chalice. So I did that with the Necco wafer, and I picked up the chalice. Made a big sign of the cross. Drank it down. Went into meditative prayer. Talking about a fourth grader. When that thing got down through my throat and into my stomach and started making its way in all directions and reached my body temperature, and that nice combination went, I am telling you, I could feel the flow of the power all the way through. Ooh. I could feel it going down my legs. Ooh! I could feel it going into my feet. And you know what my toes did? My toes went, whoa! I don't know. I don't think I had the words for it. But I had the knowledge. I knew at that moment I had something I wanted or felt I wanted, needed or felt I needed. What was it? Power. Power. I can do things. And the alcohol is cunning. It did help me do things. I was a very bookish child, very reticent, very withdrawn. Once in a while, I lived in a neighborhood, there weren't too many houses at all, a lot of great big open lots. But once in a while, I would go down where a group of kids, guys, met in a big field. For a pickup ball. Never see that anymore. Two sides. I didn't go down there too often because the libretto was always the same. Whoever who were going to be the people to choose, one would stand there and say, I choose John, I take Pete, I take Bill, I take Sam. I take Tom, I take Dick, I take Harry, and all the way down the line. And then what do you think is standing there? And then this lovely way that children have, to be able to hear in this stage whisper, one of the team choosers saying to the other, You take him. I had him the last time. Okay, Colt, come on. You're to play this, you play that. Colt, go out in left field. Farther. I empathize dearly and deeply with poor Lucy and Peanuts. But for some reason, I never became, of course, Earl Averill or Joe DiMaggio or anything near it. But I did start to go up the ladder of choice after I got this power about a choice. It would be Sam, Tom, Dick, Harry, Jim. Where is this confidence coming from? Where is this self-confidence coming from? You know where it's coming from? MASH! Isn't that a religious experience? Wowie! There is a law in the Catholic Church that no priest may offer more than one mass a day unless the good of the people demands it. If the good of the people demands it, then you may say two. Now that's the law. I'm in the fourth grade. I'm breaking church laws already. Because I would say one mass with the wine. I'm still not, you know, going for wine. It just says mixed up with the mass. Now, let's say another one. Let's say another one. And I was never picked up on this. My mother never picked up on it. I was further fortunate to have a mother who was in the restaurant business. She had three restaurants in Cleveland, Ohio, which is my hometown. They were all in different places. They all had basements and storage rooms. When I got into high school, I had free access to all these restaurants, come and go whenever I wanted to. Do anything I wanted. Spoiled rotten. I still did not have, when I walked into high school in this whole new setting, real, true, honest, legitimate self-confidence. I still did not feel that people really accepted me, that people really wanted me. So when you feel that way, you know, at least I did, how do you get friends? How do you get friends? How did I get friends? Bribe them. Bribe them. And in the course of my high school years, I have to tell you that in a certain sense, I became one of the most popular students. I was invited to, I believe, almost every party that was thrown in the city of Cleveland for 4 years. Every high school party. Catholic, non-Catholic, Jewish, Buddhist, anything. Ask Coke. Why? Because whenever I came to those parties, I brought a case of whiskey. How did I get that case of whiskey? I went to the three restaurants, I went to the storage room, and I stole so many bottles from each restaurant. I'm into stealing in high school. I have to tell you this, because it's also part of an ongoing amendment I need to make and can't make, so I have to make it by stating it. One of the men that worked in my mother's restaurant, bartender, man with a family of 5 children, worked very hard, was a very good man. But my mother suddenly realized that there seemed to be whiskey missing. And of course, she never suspected me. But she began to watch. She started watching this one bartender, and he did just a few things, I don't know what they were, but they gave her some reason to be more suspicious. She watched, and she told me about that one day. She thought that his name was Ori. I think Ori is Stephen. You know what I did? Because I felt it getting close, I confirmed her. I confirmed her suspicion. I manipulated a story that incriminated that man. And as a result of that whole little episode, that man, my mother fired that man. A man who had a family. I'm only in high school, and I am already immune to the feelings, the situation of other people. Oh, the power is in me, isn't it? The power is in me. It's a blood-curdling statement because it is so radically true. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful, full of power. And those who drink it, ingest it, become cunning, baffling, full of power. I went into college, continued drinking, stealing from my own mother. And felt no compunction about this. What did happen was, that I knew it was starting somehow to get out of control. I knew somehow that I might have to look at this. But I didn't want to. And so when you are going to continue doing something, when your head is saying, go ahead and do it, but your gut is saying to you, however faint the voice, the gut inside of you is saying, don't. Back off. Stop. You ever listen to your gut? That's why the program says we need meditation time, to listen to our gut. You know where the word gut comes from, G-U-T? Etymologically, it comes from G-O-T-T, German, Gott. And G-O-T-T is the German word for God.
Gott! Ach, mein Gott! 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 Gott!
We finally found the great reality. Where do we find it, the big book says? Where do we find it? Deep within ourselves, which in the last analysis is the only place it can be found. Oh, God, please listen to your gut. Please. Please pray. Please meditate. Please find quiet time. And say, this is what my head is saying, and my head wants to kill me. And my gut does it. My gut wants life. Listen to your gut. But the insidiousness of the alcohol is that it is going to squelch the voice of the Spirit. It's going to make this voice up here come out louder and louder and louder. This place that is full of power. Don't tell me my ideas are wrong. Don't tell me my concepts are wrong. Don't tell me my attitudes are wrong. Don't tell me my visions are wrong. Don't tell me my viewpoints are wrong. I know. So we listen to that. That reminds me of little Calvin. There's a little cartoon a year or so ago. He stands sitting on his little sled at the top of the hill, and he's sitting there looking down this thing. And he said, you can hear above his head the thing, go ahead, you can make it. Go ahead, it's not too steep. Go ahead, you won't hit that tree. Go ahead, you'll get by that little hole. And finally, in the last frame of the cartoon, he's sitting there looking and he says, my head is trying to kill me. So at this particular point in my life, I would not listen to the gut. You think, down, 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 down. You listen to the head. And so when you start listening to the head, what do you start doing with the head? What do you do with the head? You rationalize. And when you rationalize, you justify. And to rationalize, you've got to have reasons. Real, false, true, imaginary, anything. But I had something ready-made that was going to become the source, the impetus to continue my drinking, which the big book says is number one offender. You want to go back to drinking, drugging? You want to stay unhappy even though you're not drinking or drugging? You know what to do? For God's sakes, find a resentment. Get one, get one. It is bound to keep you unhappy. And as long as you stay unhappy, then you're moving closer and closer to the bottle. You know, I've seen that. I worked for some time in a treatment center and saw this, and so many of the patients would come in, you know, for their fifth step. And they would sit there and go for 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours. And just listening. And they would finally get it all out. I used to call the fifth step the puke step. And I used to tell them, you know, because the scriptures, the Bible says this, huh? The Lord says this, huh? Don't be like dogs. You're sick, you got sickness inside, and you want to share it and get it out. Puke! Puke it all out on the floor. I used to tell them, come in the room, close the door, and let's start puking. But don't be like a dog after you've got all that puke down there. they would do it, and I could see it. I could just see them. It's like they would get up, you know, thank you, sir, I feel so good, and so on, so on. And they're backing away towards the door. But you know that they have a little red wagon right back there. And as they're going out the door, they pick up and go down into the puke. I better hold on to that one. I better hold on to that. And out they go with the little red wagon. Oh, I feel so good.
See that? You just can't take away all their reasons for drinking. You just can't. I won't have you take them all away from me. I got to keep a few reasons in case things don't, you know, quite work. Maybe the sponge of it won't quite work. I got to have something there. You know what to do then? Get a resentment. And hold on to it for dear life. And that's what I did. I got a resentment. It was ready-made for me. My family, in which I was reared, was totally Irish, Catholic, Democratic. Three qualities for success. Can you believe that? When I used to date girls, this is how brainwashed I was. Somebody's saying, you know, you got this gal, you want to go out on a blind date? What's the first question? Is she a Catholic girl? Yeah, okay. Is she Irish? Yeah. Third, is she Democratic? She's Republican. Forget it. But I had a loving, wonderful grandmother, born in Ireland. In fact, my grandmother and grandfather, maternal, were both born in Ireland. Came to this country when they were very young, met, saved some money, got on the boat, went back to Ireland, got married in Ireland, conceived and delivered 5 children on Irish soil, and when the 5th one was ready to travel, they got back on the boat, came back to Amerikay, and set up housekeeping, and went into separate bedrooms for the rest of their lives. Because they did not want any children who were not conceived and delivered on Irish soil. My grandfather never drank before that, but he did after that. The poor man. My grandmother hated drink with a passion. And I used to tell her, you know, when we would be cutesy with her, we'd call her Nellie. And I'd simply say, well, Nellie, you know why he drinks. Gotta do something at nighttime. But at any rate, my grandmother, beautiful woman, please don't go, I loved her dearly, but she was a blockhead. And the church, her church, my church, made her a blockhead. Square, a real square. Everything, I heard it until it just sickened me. The church says, the church says, the Father says, no matter what it was, couldn't do anything. Church says, don't do that. Father says, don't do that. Church says, you go to hell if you do that. Father says, you go to hell if you do that. I was afraid to play with my navel.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with me this morning. I'm amusing myself. But at any rate, and now I'm going to share something, and please don't, I'm not making any criticism, I'm making no judgment. I love my grandmother dearly, with all my heart. Wonderful, wonderful woman, but she had this failing of being. My mother could only go to first year high school and had to quit, because they were very poor. And that's when she started in the restaurant, but she went to work in a little greasy spoon as a waitress, which she finally bought some years later. But at any rate, at the age of 15, she conceived me out of wedlock. My grandmother loved my mother, but my grandmother's response was conditioned by this. You are going to go to hell. For having a baby outside of wedlock, you will go to hell. To strike one against the poor woman. My mother went to a place called, can you imagine this kind of nomenclature? And was right out on the lawn. I saw it years later. She went all by herself. No mother, no father, no sisters, no brother, nobody. She went to a place called St. Anne's Home for Wayward Girls. Can you imagine a little 15-year-old girl walking into a place and seeing that sign? I'm one of those. I'm wayward. She went in and she delivered me all by herself. Whoever was there, I don't know who helped. But there was no mother and there was no father. And there were no brothers, and there were no sisters, and there was no husband. And I was baptized there. And on my baptismal record is this statement. James Edward, son of Mary Lucille Collins, and this is the loving church, and in Latin, so we won't offend you too much, son of Mary Lucille Collins and Pater Ignotus, father unknown. That's on my baptismal record. It was. The church has changed this now, the full attitude. They no longer do those things. But that was on the baptismal record that I saw. And so right there, baptizing me, what were they saying about me by that statement? What were they saying about me? James Edward, the bastard. And I want you to know, that's what I am. But I'm a happy bastard. I'll show you. However, as it happened, 3 months after I was delivered, my mother has somehow contacted my natural father and persuaded him to marry her, if for only one reason, to legitimize me according to the state. So she did marry him in the presence of a JP. My grandmother heard about this, You have a baby outside of wedlock, one, strike one. You get married before a JP, the church says you cannot do that, father says you'll go to hell if you do that, strike two. And however it happened that this ghetto Irish girl did it, I don't know. But it is strike three for sure, because my natural father was an 18-year-old, fallen-away Orthodox Jew. You're out. As it then happened, when I got 3 years old, my mother then met my stepfather, married him, and he's a very lovely man, wonderful man, and he adopted me, and that's the name I share right now, there right now, very happily and proudly, because I've never known my own father at all. But you see what that did? You see, that what that did, putting my mother out, it put her out. She was what we call in the case excommunicated. You're out of communication. You don't belong in this community. And I can remember for years, my mother went to church every single Sunday. She never missed. She did everything that a good practicing active Catholic was to do. But she just did it. She gave away her restaurant to priests. If a priest walked in with a family, with a party of 25 people, no charge. You know what she was trying to do? Buy her way in, buy her way in, buy her way in. She would go to church, and we had a great big mammoth church, great big column, and she would go way back and stand behind the column through the entire service. Stand there, hidden in the dark. Because she did not feel that she was worthy to be with you good people. You're all good. I'm no good. She suffered dearly. My mother never drank, even though she was in the business. Maybe a glass of champagne on New Year's Eve or something. She worked, 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 worked. And she gave. Until the last couple years of her life, she picked up the bottle. I never saw anybody deteriorate so fast in my whole life. Within a year and a half, she was totally cirrhotic. Totally cirrhotic. Her stomach was way out like that. She was going to the hospital every couple of weeks to be tapped. She shrank away. Her color became orange. Her eyeballs, whole eyes were orange. She had little tiny spindly legs. Little tiny spindly arms. The monkey woman. Did you ever see the picture of the monkey man? The monkey woman. Zombie, walking zombie. You know one of the reasons we drink? Drug? To diminish pain. To diminish pain. Pain in the body? Spiritual pain. Spiritual pain. That's why if you stop drinking and you don't have a program of spirituality to take care of the pains inside, forget it. Forget it. If you don't see the 12 steps as a program of spirituality to help you deal with the pain, forget it. If I were to say to you this statement, make this statement, write it on a blackboard in front of you, how would you fill in it? This is a fill-in sentence. What would you put in here? In every human being, if you've been on retreat with me, don't answer. If I were to say to you this statement, make this statement, write it on a blackboard in front of you, how would you fill in it? This is a fill-in sentence. What would you put in here? In every human being, if you've been on retreat with me, don't answer. In every human being there is good and evil, right? In every human being there is good and evil. In every human being there is good and bad. I don't subscribe to that because of my concept of God. Now, I say this, in every human being there is good and pain. And the pain leads to and prompts some very bad behavior. So we better start dealing with that pain. And that's what this woman was, full of pain. Full of spiritual pain. Psychological pain. Just loaded. And so just in sheer desperation, she started to drink. She came to die. In fact, she was in and out of hospitals all over the city of Cleveland. I couldn't even get her into hospitals anymore because if she got feeling well, she would walk right out and go right to work and start working. And they refused to take her. And finally, there was a little hospital called Woman's Hospital, and I got her in there. And she was comatose. Comatose. Went in about September. Nothing. The doctor said, she's going to die. She's going to die. I said, good, please. Towards the end in December, in fact, Christmas Eve, I went to the hospital and visited her. She was lying in this little bed, and she suddenly started making noises. And I started listening. And it wasn't just a question of noises, but it was a repetition of the same noise. The intonations were the same. And I'm listening. What is she trying to say? I went and I held her hand. And I just said, Mama, I said, keep saying it, and I'll keep saying what it sounds like. And when I get it right, squeeze my hand. And we kept doing this and doing this. Christmas Eve, through the day. When I finally got it, you know what she was saying? I want my mama. I went home to the grandmother and I told her, she's calling for you. She said, I cannot go. She said, let her call. She's going to hell, so let her call. I went back, and this kept up, and I got back in the car, went back home. And I said, Grandma, put on your coat, put on your hat, put on your galoshes, put on your gloves, and we're going to the hospital. I said, either you put them on, or I'm going to pick you up right now and carry you, and I don't give a damn if you get pneumonia. But you're going to go. So she finally did. We got to the hospital, came into the hospital. I went into my mother's room. The bed was lying along this way. My mother was lying there with her head to the wall. I came in at the foot of the bed, stood there. My grandma's out in the hallway, standing out there. I said, Grandma, get in here. So she walks in the room, the bed is there, with her eyes straight out in the window. But you know what? Her eyes were full of tears. Full of tears. Because I knew she loved her daughter. But she would not look at her. And at that moment, when she stepped over the threshold, my mother was lying that way, facing the wall. She turned her head over and her eyes opened up. And I said, my God, she's all together. She's got her senses completely. Her eyes were wide open, vivid, bright. She turned around, she looked up, and she saw that woman standing there. And you know what she said? I'm sorry for being a bad girl. And she died.
And my grandmother, tears, turned around and walks out of the room. I am not blaming my grandmother. I did not blame my grandmother that time. You know who I blamed? The church. Blamed the church. Because I saw this whole thing, and I saw this whole desperate life. And this is the thing I had. This is the thing I had to grab onto. Isn't that a lovely thing to fuel your drinking? You want to drink? Couldn't I stay? If I was at a bar right now and I just told you this lovely little story and you were sitting next to me listening to this story, do you know what you would say to me when I got finished? Oh, my God, man, let me buy you a drink. No wonder you drink. I would have got all the affirmation I need. That's a wonderful place to go. Go to bars. As long as you're willing to listen to somebody else's story, they got to listen to yours. And you got the reasons to drink. So I used that. I took a hold of that resentment. And I held it and I kept thinking about it. And I kept meditating on it. Resent. What does that mean? To feel it over again. 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 Feel it. Feel it. Ah, the damn church. Killed my mother. Killed the relationship with my mother. I got the damn church. I had what I needed to drink. But when you hold on to a resentment, dear friends, and please know this, when you hold on, from my experience, if you hold on to resentment, if you nurse it and you hold it there and hug it to yourself and just nurse it, you know what it's going to become? Revenge. You've got to get even now. You've got to get even. And that's what I determined on. I am going to get even with the Catholic Church. I am going to make them pay for this. How? Have you guessed? I will become a priest. That is humorous only in hindsight. That was deadly serious at that time. That was my motivation for becoming a priest 37 years ago. I am going to get the church, and what better place to get the church than from within? And I got to tell you, really, truly, I said, you know, I want to be a priest, bull roar. I did not want to be a priest at all. I was determined I was going to be a bishop. Why? Power. For whatever reasons, in the great providence of Almighty God, I don't know. When I was ordained, I played a beautiful game all the way through the seminary. I'm telling you. I was reminded of my whole attitude. I was at an Al-Anon meeting up in Potosi a week or so ago. And one of the gals was talking. I can't remember the whole context, but she said, you know, describing herself and how we are. She said, if there were two doors in a room, one was marked God, lecture about God on the other door, which one do you think we would go into? The lecture about God. So that's what I did. I learned a lot about God. That's what theology is all about. I waxed eloquent in the pulpit. My God, last week I got a letter from a sister who found out where I was after 37 years. 37 years ago, I was teaching with that woman. And she wrote, and I wrote up the thing, her little note, I'm so glad I found you. And she said, oh, Father. She said, I've never forgotten your beautiful sermons. Talk about God. That's an art. That's an art. Just like talk about the program. That's an art. You can develop that art. And so I did. I proved myself. So much so that when I was ordained, some of the professors in the seminary told me, they said, "Oh, James, you've done such a marvelous job through all these years, these 3 years of theology, much marvelous and so on, and all this stuff." I said, "We think you're going to be the bishop's secretary." I smiled demurely. But inside myself, when they said the bishop's secretary, I said, "Baloney. I am going to be the bishop." As luck, the hand of God would have it. The hand of God was moving in my life already in a certain sense. I was not made the bishop's secretary. Can you imagine what my first appointment was? To go to our seminary, Idaho Seminary, and be the spiritual director. We had 8 years, 4 years of high school students and 4 years of college students. The college men had to come to me as spiritual director twice a year. Twice a year for spiritual advice. They had to. They could come more often, but they had to do that. And do you know what I saw in this? A marvelous opportunity to get even. And this is now pure fifth step. Trusted servants. This is pure fifth step. Those men came into my room, and with the deviousness, the cunningness, the baffling in my own mind, I very insidiously tried to find ways to destroy their vocation. I don't know how to make up for that, other than to share it. I don't think that happened because I wanted it to do that. That doesn't make any difference. I think there's other factors. What matters is this was in my heart. This was in my mind. This was my motivation. This is my cunningness. This is my way of getting even. Dear friends, what do you think happens when you live like that? You labor under these kind of things going on in your head, in this kind of insidiousness, this kind of duplicity, getting up and waxing eloquent about God and turning around and trying to destroy somebody's vocation at the same time. What do you think that does? That brings pain. And what is the only relief I know for pain? Drink. And I did. And it got worse and worse and worse. In the course of that, I totaled 5 people's cars. 2 of them belonged to me, 3 belonged to other people. I gave this talk over at Grand Rapids, my open talk a couple months ago. And do you know what was happening? There was somebody sitting in the audience who kept looking at me and smiling, a little smirk on his face. And I couldn't quite recognize anything. When I got all finished, this man came over to say, thank you. And as he walked, he opened his mouth, and I said, "Oh, my God! This is one of the men whose cars I wrecked." When he was a college student in the seminary. He let me use it because I had no car because I'd wrecked it. I cannot go in, and I will not go into all the scandals. Scandalous behavior. We're done with a band without care. It didn't make a damn bit of difference to me whether my name was in the paper for doing this and being caught for this. For being in this wreck, for being caught speeding, for being caught with booze in the car. Give it to him. It's another way of tearing down the church. Tearing it down, tearing it down. I'm talking about my motivation. My purposes. I can remember my poor bishop, who was one of my great enablers. He did not want to admit I was an alcoholic. Can you imagine with all this behavior? He did not want to admit that. You know what he did to me? In the toll? He sent me to 5 nut houses. Anything but an alcoholic, he said. Goofy, nutsy, anything but. I am the product also of 15 treatment centers. So anybody who's shaky, take heart. I hope you're up here. And one time he called me in to see him. One time he called me, oh my God. Another time he called me into his office. And I walked in the room, and the poor bishop was sitting at his desk, behind the desk, and I sat down, and he is sitting there like this. His head is going back and forth. And he looked up at me. I have never in my life seen a human being transformed into a beagle hound. Look. It was heartbreaking. I was near tears. The look on this man's face, and he looked at me and he said, Father James, do you know I'm afraid to open the morning paper? Well, at any rate, it continued, and that didn't faze me at all, really. It didn't really truly faze me. I was applauding within, you know. Go with it, see what that does, you know. I don't care what disgrace, anything. I have to tell you another thing that fueled my resentment. The Catholic Church at that time had a very strange law that if you are illegitimate, if you are a bastard, you can never be a priest in your own home diocese. So I was not a priest in Cleveland, Ohio. But if somebody else will take you, you can go there. So a diocese in Wisconsin took me, and that's where I ended up. But that was also fueled by resentment, you see. But at any rate, I've got to start shutting up. The bishop finally told me, called me in, and he said, Father James, he said, I am going to send you to St. Louis, Missouri. He said, you're going to stay there at least 10 years. He said, maybe in 10 years' time, the people in the Diocese of Wisconsin will have forgotten. And they had a lot of things to forget, poor people. That was horrible to scandalize people, scandalize their faith. That's what I did, anyway. It didn't make any difference. So he sent me down to St. Louis. I got on the plane, I got off the plane, I got in the cab. I said to the cabbie, I said, I would like to go to St. Vincent's. And he turned around and he said, which one? I said, what do you mean, which one? He said, well, do you want to go to the hospital or to the nut house? And I said, the one on Rock Road. He said, oh, the nut house. So at any rate, they got me in here. I'm going to just tell you this one story because it's significant in my growth. I got in the next day, the doctor came in, Dr. Hennessy Jones. Never forget, he was a lovely man. And we sat and talked, and finally at the end he said, well, Reverend, he said, you're coming at a bad time. I said, oh, what? He said, I'm going on vacation for 6 weeks. So I said, Okay. He said, so would you like to have another doctor? And I looked at him, and I said, no, I'll go with what I have. I'll wait. So he left, and I did not know, and I don't know whether he did it deliberately or not, but it was done by God. It was providential. He left no orders for me, which meant I could not leave the room at all without an orderly. And I developed another resentment that I cannot do anything about. I still have a resentment against orderlies. I don't think I'm going to give it up. Because you got to stand in your room down here, you know, with one foot in the room and the other foot out in the hallway, and way down there at the back is where the orderlies are standing. Way back there, down there. And they're standing there laughing and talking and, you know, flirting with the nurse and all kinds of nice things. And you're going, one and two. Now! And you know what they do, those orderlies do? They see you down there. You know what they do when they see you? They go right on, ho, 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 pinching the nurse, boom. And they take out a cigarette, and takes them 1 hour to get the cigarette pack out, takes them 1 hour to get the cigarette out of there, takes them 1 hour to get the cigarette into their mouth, it takes 1 hour to find the match, it takes 1 hour to light it. When they have that thing lighted, that cigarette lighted, they drag and drag and drag and drag and drag. And you know what they do? They go look down the hallway and they go. And you know what happens? That happens. You know what happens? That smoke comes. But anyway, I don't know. I got to the point anyway, to make any difference. Because when they finally do come and took me to the bathroom, which is all open, there are no partitions or nothing, and you sit on the throne, you know, like this, and you have to go. You know what they do in a room that's completely open? They bring in a chair. And they look at you eyeball to eyeball. I dare you to have a bowel movement with that condition. There is absolutely only one recourse that you have. You constipate. That's your only defense. But at any rate, when I first got there and found out there were no orders, I was so angry, so terribly, terribly angry. Because now, you see, I'm in a position where I'm losing control. I don't have all the power. I can't do everything I want to do. You're going to stay in that room. And I started walking back and forth in that room, pacing up and down, 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 up and down. I will never forget this. As I paced, you know what happened for some reason psychologically to me? The room got smaller and smaller, and the ceiling started coming down, 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 and I'm just... And I picked up the bed, picked up the mattress, threw it out in the floor, hallway, the pillows, everything. Picked up the bed and went towards the doorway. Boom! Back. Boom! Picked up the chair, threw it out in the hallway, went up to the window that had bars in it, took my fists and went boom, 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 boom. You know what happened? The bed stayed out of the room, the mattress stayed out of the room, the chair stayed out of the room. Everything was taken out of the room. And you know what happened? The little Cokie boy is sitting in the middle of the floor. marvelous. I can't do anything. It's one way God can work. Because I sat there in that floor, and you know what happened? I began to think and think. And I thought about as much as I could, and it was all mixed up. But I began to think, maybe that's the reason for the whole thing from the very beginning. I'd never had it together. I was born congenitally insane. And I sat there, and I began to deal with that. And it came to this. And I didn't know that much about AA really at that time at all. But I came to this conclusion. Coke, you are absolutely, definitively, ultimately, finally, crazy. And you know what I did? It's incurable. You will never ever get sane, Coke. You are absolutely insane. You know what I did? What do you do when you deal with something like that? When you deal with reality, what is the one thing you can do?
Surrender.
I surrendered to insanity. It was beautiful. Everything was a great relief. Everything seemed to float away. Everything seemed to have some kind of a meaning because you are crazy. You know what happened then? My world. William James says one of the greatest discoveries of our time is that if you can change the inner attitudes of your mind, you will change the outer aspects of your life. Change the inner attitudes of your mind. I changed it. I'm crazy. And that flowed out. And the room got bigger. My God, this is a big room. Wow. They gave me back my bed. They gave me back the mattress, the sheets, the pillowcases, the blankets. They put in a chair. They even put in a desk for me. And they gave me a pencil. You don't know what that meant to me. They trusted me with this instrument. Poke out your eyes with it. But they trusted me. So I began writing. I've saved some. I began writing poems. They're very dark, dark, dark poems. Horrible. Right. But everything changed around me. This little room changed. And so I would go, and I have to go to the job. They get her. They don't. If I have to go in my pants, I have to go. It was beautiful. This lovely window that the bars had, at one time had just been like a great big black mass that all just... I never even saw the bars anymore. I disregarded them altogether. I had no feeling of being confined. I'm where I belong. This is it. This is my world. These are the realities. These are the perimeters. The periphery of my world. This is the whole thing. This is it. And it's okay. And I looked out the window and I began to enjoy things. I looked down into a tree. And during that time, you know what happened? I saw the most beautiful thing happen. I saw two blue jays mate and build a nest. And it was beautiful. The doctor came back after 6 weeks. We went through all kinds of tests, written tests, fill in blocks, read the things, put electrodes. After about a week of all this stuff, he came in on a Monday. He came in with a big sheaf of papers, and I thought, oh boy, I got a rare one. Nobody's got this in the whole world, I know. He put them all down, and he said, well, Reverend, I'm going to release you tomorrow. Come again? Yeah, you're going to be released tomorrow. I said, Doctor, you can't. You can't do that. You can't put me on the streets. I'm crazy. I'm nuts, doctor. Don't you see that? Don't you understand? I'm nuts. I'm all the things. I'm crazy, doctor. I'm incurably insane. He just looked at me so, oh, Reverend.
He said, Reverend, you are not insane at all. Yeah? Reverend, you're an alcoholic.
A blue streak came out, and I looked at that doctor and I said, Doctor, I said, now I know why you work in a place like this. They released me, but I couldn't go back home for 10 years. So I had to find something, and I did. I now have to prove I'm not an alcoholic. What's one of the typical, stereotypical ways that you prove that you're not an alcoholic? You become a workaholic. That's what I did. I started teaching in a grammar school, 7th, 8th grade, 4 grades, English. I taught Latin, 2 grades in a high school down there. I taught liturgy and scripture at Kenrick Seminary. I taught at Marillac College for Nuns. I taught at Webster Groves College. I gave conferences to a group of cloistered nuns every single week. I lived in the parish, and I had the 6 o'clock mass every morning, and I worked in their public school religious education program, and I took the devotions every Thursday night. I never said no to anything. The school I worked at, they made me principal of that school. Now I ask you, in all sincerity, you who are parents, would you hire an alcoholic to be the principal of your children's school? They hired me, therefore. I went on drinking like mad. Found out that besides bishop, there's other people that will enable you. Highly placed people like judges. Judge looked at me and said, well, we're going to write this off, Reverend. This is down in St. Louis now. I'm doing all these marvelous things, and marvelous letters are going to my bishop. He doesn't know I'm standing in the courtroom. But I want to write it off, because he said, I have a problem with booze. I've never been caught, Reverend Father, but I'm going to write it off for you. Isn't that nice? Cops? I was stopped a couple times. We're going too slow. My head was going like this, but I was driving too slow. However, and they found out, you know, they used to ask at the time, yeah, well, sir, what do you do for a living? I said, I'm a priest. And the priest says, oh my God, you're a priest, Father? Oh my God. Come back in the car. Go back in the squad car with my partner. Give me the keys. We'll take you home. Where do you live? Tell me where you live. And they would take me home, drive me home in the car. They'd get me out of the car. They'd both come. They would both take an arm and take me up the stairs. Going to the kitchen of the place I was living and make coffee. Here, Father, drink some coffee. And they would talk for a little while and say, well, Father, we got to go. Twice this happened. Where two policemen, before they left, they brought me home, and they knelt there and they said, now, Father, take care of yourself. And, Father, say a prayer for me. Of course, my son. However, those were all Irish Catholic cops. One time I was stopped, and I got a little more confidence in this cop, and he's coming over there, and he's not doing too much. He's got my license, he's fingered out and everything like this. And I said, my God, this man is serious. And I looked and I said, officer, I'm a Catholic priest. I don't give a damn if you're the Pope. You're going to jail. But anyway, a lot of good things happened. down there. A lot of good friends. Finally, after 10 years, 11 years actually, I came back to my own diocese, and I don't know whether I returned to the scene of the crime, but boy, oh boy, I'm telling you, I really went for berserk. And I finally realized something's got to be done, something's got to happen. I went to my bishop, and I said, Bishop, I said, I know there have been a lot of bad things. I've done a lot of scandal and so on. So I said, well, I have a good friend in Cleveland, Ohio, who's the county commissioner. I talked to him, and he can give me a job. And I said, Bishop, maybe I'll get my head together. If you would give me a leave, I said, maybe I'll get my head together, Bishop, if you would give me a leave of absence. You got it! Just like that, boom! And so I left, and I returned to Cleveland, Ohio. And in 13 months, I went through 15 jobs. Starting up, boom, boom, boom. Fired from every single one. The last job I had was on West 25th Street in Cleveland, Ohio, at a little motel that was nothing else but a shack-up motel. And I was the night clerk. And they fired me. Can you imagine the man who fired me said this? I'm in a shack-up motel now for lack of performance. That's only 12 years ago. I'm in my 50s. I could not get any more jobs. So what do you do when you can't get more jobs? You go to welfare. I got onto welfare. Need more money than that. I found two bodies, dead bodies, in two different alleys. And this is Skid Row, West 25th Street in Cleveland, Ohio. I found two dead bodies in the valley. I stripped them clean. I took everything off them, all their identification. I found out I knew where they lived. And you know what I did for 3 months? I collected my own welfare check plus two dead people. Until I got caught for that. Got caught. So they were moving in. And so I moved into the wall. I went down underneath the high-level bridge and up in Pond of Hole, and I started living underneath the high-level bridge. And quite literally, the picture is this. I'm lying underneath the high-level bridge, covered all over with newspapers, sucking on a brown bag, and my whole existence is around that bottle. Waking up every single morning with this prayer, God damn it. I'm alive. God damn it. Now what do I have to do? Crawl up the side of the hill, get out on the street, beg, panhandle, chase a bus stop. When you see a good old lady there, run up and snatch her purse and run. And keep doing this if you get enough money to get one bottle to go back down underneath. And go underneath the newspapers and suck on a brown bag. That's the reward of resentment become revenge. The Catholic Church is going on beautifully without me. They don't even know I'm underneath the bridge. Nobody does. And all I wanted to do was die. Except the Almighty God stepped into my life, and once again, a providential thing happened. He said, Coke, you are not going to say the word. You are not going to say it, are you? You're just not going to say it. Well, I'm going to tell you this, Cokie. I'm going to zap you with a blackout, and you'll say it in the blackout. And he did. I got zapped. It's common, but I got zapped with a blackout. In the midst of that blackout, do you know the one word I said that begins the first step and must be the word, and every time you go to a meeting, every time you consult your sponsor, every time you pick up the book, every time you pray, every time you read, no matter what it is, the one word that is the beginning of all spirituality, help! Help! I don't remember saying it. I knew five priests in Cleveland. Three of them I liked very, very much. One, they're all recovering alcoholics. One I loved. He was one of the persons I loved him so much in grammar school, I tried to bribe his friendship. And one of those guys I could not stand. Went to school with him, knew him. If he'd come down the hallway, I would run into the john and stand up on the toilet so he wouldn't see me because I want to talk to him.
But can you imagine how God works? You know my story better than I do. I called for that ass. He came, he answered the call, he picked me up, he threw me in his car. He called up Guest House of Lake Orion. They could not take me. They said, you went to through treatment with Vaughn Quinn, call up Sacred Heart, maybe they can take him until we got a room for him up here. He called up, he said, this guy has nothing, no money, no nothing, zero. Vaughn Quinn said, that's okay, bring him, we'll take him until they get the Guest House. And he drove me, stopped on the way, I know this not only in retrospect, bought me drinks to keep me together. Just keep me together. And I got into Sacred Heart. They put me up in a room. It's a long room with five beds in it, kind of long and narrow. And I came to, and I didn't know where I was. I found out I was in Detroit. I didn't know that. I was someplace in Cleveland again, another treatment center, another hospital. And I couldn't figure out how the hell did I get to Detroit, Michigan. How did I get there? And a honcho came in and told me, I asked him how, and he said, Father Gordy brought you. I said, oh, no, he did not. No, 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 no. And we went back and forth. He went down and got the admission papers, and he said, here, look, what name is that? My God, Father Gordy. How do I explain this? I am out of control of this one. I sat there in that room, long, narrow, and it was a memory of that room in the insane asylum where I surrendered to insanity. And that I sat in that room, looked down, there was nobody in the room, I had the feeling that I was in a casket. And in the Catholic Church, when they bring the casket, they put over what they call a pall, it's a big covering, so it's over the whole casket. And I had a feeling sitting there that the pall was coming down, 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 down. Which one? Here? Or there? I found out. But now I'm going to do something. Because I don't think I've said it all the way through, and I tried deliberately not to really do it. Sitting there when I felt that concept, I was in a casket and it was death. It was all finished. Do you know what I said? The best prayer I've ever said in my life. Thank God. Thank you, God. I give up. I give up. And just like that, the same feeling that I had in that same phenomenon left. I was freed. I was freed.